Hello, this is Rachel Durkin Durga, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the 1st of October issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. System outage at Canada-US border resolved after causing delays for commercial truck traffic, by Joshua Smith and Josh McGinnis. A system outage at Canada-US border crossings in southern Ontario caused difficulties and delays for commercial trucks Tuesday, the Canada Border Services Agency says. The agency said the outage, which began around 10:15 a.m., affected processing for commercial drivers at several crossings. Shortly after 1:30 p.m., the CBSA said the issue had been partially resolved, but warned commercial drivers could still face delays. The outage had ended by 7:30 p.m., a CBSA spokesperson told the Star. Quote, issues began following routine maintenance on Sunday morning and were resolved earlier this afternoon, end quote. CBSA Media Relations Manager Guillaume Berube wrote. Berube added that a data entry problem caused the system outage and it's being investigated. The CBSA said earlier Tuesday that primary inspection lanes at the Peace Bridge and Queenston-Lewiston Bridge were staffed with officers to process traffic and shipments. The agency added it was working with the Peace Bridge Authority and the Niagara Falls Bridge Commission to help manage traffic. According to government data, Southern Ontario border crossings processed 2.7 million commercial trucks and vehicles and 7.3 million commercial shipments in 2023. On Sunday, travelers also faced delays flying into a number of Canadian airports, including Pearson, due to a service interruption involving the CBSA's primary inspection kiosks. Canada in Investment Crisis, Business Council says in Federal Budget Submission, by Nick Murray. The Business Council of Canada says Canada is in an, quote, investment crisis, end quote, but warns prosperity can't be achieved by taking on more debt. In a letter to Prime Minister Mark Carney, the Council's president and CEO Goldie Hyder said if the federal government intends on financing investment by incurring more debt, then it better have a plan to bring it down. Quote, we recognize the difficult starting point and the need for upfront investments, but that should be underwritten by meaningful year-over-year reductions in the absolute deficit, end quote, Hyder wrote, saying at the very least, the government should have this year's deficit within 3 years. The Council's submission is one of nearly 1,000 the government received in recent weeks, ahead of the Liberals' budget tabling on November 4. A projection by the Interim Parliamentary Budget Officer last week warned the federal deficit could jump to $68.5 billion this year, up from an estimated $51.7 billion last year. In his letter, Hyder urged Carney to keep spending in check. Quote, spending control also means no new unfunded permanent programs. Any ongoing spending increase should be matched by permanent savings or an identified revenue source, end quote, Hyder wrote, noting the government should hold spending growth below nominal GDP growth. Quote, priorities need to be traded off, not layered on top of each other, end quote. Hyder also warned against the government's plan to split operating and capital budgets, with the latter classified as anything which builds an asset, versus government salaries and Social Security payments, for example. The Liberal Party election platform called for such a change, pitching it as a way to, quote, create a more transparent categorization of the expenditure that contributes to capital formation in Canada, end quote. It also said it's how other countries, like the United Kingdom, does it. In his letter, Hyder disagreed. Quote, experts caution it is unnecessary and risks being used to relabel current spending as investment, end quote, he wrote. Quote, if the government proceeds, it must be governed by clear, public definitions and an independent oversight mechanism to maintain credibility, end quote. The council also conducted a survey over the last month and a half of its members, economists, policy experts, and former senior officials. They almost unanimously agreed the government needs to have fiscal anchors in place to ensure political discipline and force trade-offs for new spending. A fiscal anchor is a guiding principle governments can point to in their budgets to show they're prudently managing public finances, particularly debt. Quote, both BCC members and experts reject simplistic rules, strongly favoring a dashboard approach that provides a complete view of fiscal health, rather than judging a budget based on one fiscal anchor, end quote, read a report on the survey. Quote, members strongly preferred a combination of rules rather than a single one based on any individual metric, end quote. Most respondents cited the need for a debt-to-GDP ratio that's either on a stable or declining path in the medium term, while a vocal group stressed the need to keep debt servicing costs in check. Others called for balanced budgets. The previous Liberal government under former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau set an anchor of capping the annual deficit at 1% of GDP and maintaining a declining debt-to-GDP ratio. The PBO report last week forecasted Ottawa will blow past these anchors in the upcoming budget, with an expectation the federal debt-to-GDP ratio will no longer decline in the coming years. Interim Parliamentary Budget Officer Jason Jacques told a parliamentary committee last week it was the first time in 30 years he has seen a projection where the key metric rises over time. The Liberal election platform promised to balance the operating budget by 2028 and ensure the government debt-to-GDP ratio declines over the budget horizon. Minimum wage increases in Ontario today, but is it enough to keep up with inflation? By Anastasia Blosser. Ontarians who are earning minimum wage can expect to see a boost in their paychecks starting Wednesday, as the province raises the rate to keep up with inflation. Minimum wage is increased every year to reflect the changing cost of food, clothing, shelter, and other goods, according to a media release from the province. Even with the adjustment, some advocacy groups say pay rates are still below what workers actually need to live on, especially in more metropolitan areas like Toronto. Beginning on October 1, the general minimum wage will go up from $17.20 to $17.60 an hour, a 2.4% jump that was calculated according to the Ontario Consumer Price Index. Tips and gratuities aren't considered wages and aren't included when calculating minimum wage, according to the Employment Standards Act. Though the general wage rate applies to most workers, some groups have different pay rates. Students who are under the age of 18 and work 28 hours a week will also be seeing a 40-cent increase from $16.20 to $16.60 an hour. Employees who work from home and make minimum wage in specified jobs, such as sewing clothes, answering the phone for a call center, or writing software for a high-tech company, will make $19.35 an hour compared to the previous $18.90 per hour. Students under 18 who work from home are also entitled to this pay rate. The minimum wage for hunting, fishing, and wilderness guides is based on blocks of time instead of by the hour. If they work less than five consecutive hours a day, the minimum wage is $88.05, but that increases to $176.15 if they work five or more hours in a day, regardless of whether they are worked consecutively or not. If a worker's pay is based on commission, either entirely or partially, it must still be equal to or more than the minimum wage for each hour they worked. Once the increase comes into effect, Ontario will have the second highest provincial minimum wage and the fifth highest across Canada. British Columbia has the highest minimum wage of all the provinces at $17.85 an hour. All three Canadian territories have higher minimum wages than any of the provinces. Quote, at a time when many families are feeling the pressure of global economic uncertainty, our government will protect Ontario workers with a minimum wage increase that supports our world-class workforce, end quote. David Piccini, Minister of Labour, Immigration, Training, and Skills Development, said. The federal minimum wage was last increased on April 1 to $17.75 an hour, and is also adjusted to keep pace with year-over-year cost of living increases. While minimum wage is calculated to keep pace with inflation, some advocacy groups argue that the basis should actually be a, quote, living wage, end quote, which reflects what people need to earn to cover the actual cost of living in their community. According to the Ontario Living Wage Network, or OLWN, workers in the Greater Toronto Area would need to earn $26 an hour to cover their food, shelter, clothing, transportation, medical, and childcare needs, with enough left over for some recreational activities and an occasional modest vacation. That means minimum wage workers in the GTA would need a 48% wage boost to meet the living wage from 2024, even after the upcoming inflationary increase. Craig Pickthorne, the OLWN's communications director, said employees making minimum wage in Toronto could still be $300 short from making ends meet every week, a deficit that keeps some in, quote, working poverty, end quote. Quote, that means you'd now have to get another job, or you have to maybe enter the gig economy, he said. People start to have to make terrible decisions like what bills they're going to go into arrears on so that they can cover rent, end quote. Whereas the province uses the Consumer Price Index, which takes the price change of different goods and services on Ontario, the OLWN calculates beyond products that the average person consumes. Quote, there's more than just paying the basic bills. You want to be able to, like, go out in the community and go to a festival or go to see a movie or just participate in society. The living wage affords some of that, but it is still a very modest existence, he explained. The OLWN calculations don't include savings set aside for retirement or buying a home, end quote. The Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, or CCPA, proposed a second way to calculate how much money Torontonians need to live, how much money workers would need to earn to rent a standard one-bedroom. To rent a standard one-bedroom apartment in Toronto without spending more than 30% of their monthly income, a worker in the city would need to make at least $37.84 an hour. If they wanted to rent a two-bedroom, they would need to earn $48.94 an hour. Under this model, two people working minimum wage jobs would not be able to rent a one-bedroom apartment together without spending more than 30% of their paycheck on shelter, according to the organization's Ontario Research Director and political economist Ricardo Tranjan. Quote, the minimum wage is not anchored in any concrete measure, he said, adding that it is a political decision. It has no direct relation with the cost of living, end quote. Hundreds gather in Montreal to reflect on Canada's legacy of residential schools by Miriam LaFontaine. Faye Lisa Gagne, who hails from the Musqueam First Nation in Saskatchewan, has complicated feelings about the word reconciliation. As a child, she was placed into care with a Francophone family in Quebec's eastern townships, where she could only speak English. Her mother attended residential school, and her four siblings were lost to the 60s scoop, a period when governments in Canada oversaw the large-scale removal of Indigenous children from their homes to live with mostly non-Indigenous caregivers. And today, Gagne said, Indigenous children in Canada continue to be overrepresented in the country's child welfare systems. Quote, we talk about reconciliations, but it's hard to reconcile when you know about the politics of assimilation, end quote, said Gagne, speaking from the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation gathering held in Montreal on Tuesday at Mount Royal Park. Quote, and specifically when you lost your identity, your language, your culture by being adopted out, end quote. Gagné was among hundreds that came out to the event in honor of residential school survivors like her mother. She said she only got to reconnect with her briefly in 2007 before she passed away months later. A lot of negative events and violence happened in those walls, end quote, she said about her mother's experience growing up in a residential school south of Regina. Quote, they were not allowed to speak their language. She lost it, end quote. Tuesday marked the fifth National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, a day created in recognition of Canada's legacy of residential schools. About 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend the church-run, government-funded schools between 1857 and 1996. The institutions were often rife with abuse, unsuitable living conditions, and high rates of infections like pneumonia. In 2015, Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission concluded the residential school system had been created in an attempt to destroy and assimilate Indigenous people, an effort it characterized as, quote, cultural genocide, end quote. Gagné said those legacies of assimilation continue across Canada's child welfare policies. First Nations children are 6 to 8 times more likely to be placed into care than non-Indigenous children, according to the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. Kana Sohan Kevin Deere said each Orange Shirt Day brings up feelings of sadness. The Canadian government tried to erase everything that makes Indigenous people who they are, their language, their creation stories, their songs, dances, and history, he said, but it didn't succeed. Quote, it's the recognition of the atrocities our people have had to experience as a result of this attitude of superiority that we're going to kill the Indian to save the man, end quote, said Deere, an elder from Kahnawake, a First Nation community south of Montreal. But he said this day is also one that makes him feel hopeful. Quote, we have all of this pain, but let's learn from it, end quote, Deere said. Quote, let's put our best minds together to make it better so that future generations can inherit a happy, safe, clean, beautiful, peaceful, loving home, end quote. Singer Leonard Sumner traveled from Little Saskatchewan First Nation in Manitoba to perform in front of the crowd. He said it's important to honor the children that were taken away from their families. Many parents only had good intentions when their children were sent to residential schools, he said. Quote, we trusted, and we should not be punished for trusting, end quote, he said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. U.S. government shutdown begins as the country faces new period of uncertainty. By Lisa Mascaro, Marie-Claire Jalanick, and Stephen Groves. Plunged into a government shutdown, the U.S. is confronting a fresh cycle of uncertainty after President Donald Trump and Congress failed to strike an agreement to keep government programs and services running by Wednesday's deadline. Roughly 750,000 federal workers are expected to be furloughed, some potentially fired by the Trump administration. Many offices will be shuttered, perhaps permanently, as Trump vows to, quote, do things that are irreversible, that are bad, end quote, as retribution. His deportation agenda is expected to run full speed ahead, while education, environmental, and other services sputter. The economic fallout is expected to ripple nationwide. Quote, we don't want to shut it down, end quote, Trump said at the White House before the midnight deadline. But the president, who met privately with congressional leadership this week, appeared unable to negotiate any deal between Democrats and Republicans to prevent that outcome. This is the third time Trump has presided over a federal funding lapse, the first since his return to the White House this year, in a remarkable record that underscores the polarizing divide over budget priorities and a political climate that rewards hardline positions rather than more traditional compromises. The Democrats picked this fight, which was unusual for the party that prefers to keep government running, but their voters are eager to challenge the president's second-term agenda. Democrats are demanding funding for health care subsidies that are expiring for millions of people under the Affordable Care Act, spiking the costs of insurance premiums nationwide. Republicans have refused to negotiate for now and have encouraged Trump to steer clear of any talks. After the White House meeting, the president posted a cartoonish fake video mocking the Democratic leadership that was widely viewed as unserious and racist. What neither side has devised is an easy off-ramp to prevent what could become a protracted closure. The ramifications are certain to spread beyond the political arena, upending the lives of Americans who rely on the government for benefit payments, work contracts, and the various services being thrown into turmoil. Quote, "What the government spends money on is a demonstration of our country's priorities," end quote, said Rachel Snyderman, a former White House budget official who is the managing director of economic policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center, a think tank in Washington. Shutdowns, she said, quote, "only inflict economic cost, fear, and confusion across the country," end quote. An economic jolt could be felt in a matter of days. The government is expected Friday to produce its monthly jobs report, which may or may not be delivered. While the financial markets have generally, quote, shrugged, end quote, during past shutdowns, according to a Goldman Sachs analysis, this one could be different, partly because there are no signs of broader negotiations. Quote, "there are also few good analogies to this week's potential shutdown," end quote, the analysis said. Across the government, preparations have been underway. Trump's Office of Management and Budget, headed by Russell Vought, directed agencies to execute plans for not just furloughs, as are typical during a federal funding lapse, but mass firings of federal workers. It's part of the Trump administration's mission, including its Department of Government Efficiency, to shrink the federal government. The Medicare and Medicaid health care programs are expected to continue, though staffing shortages could mean delays for some services. The Pentagon would still function, and most employees will stay on the job at the Department of Homeland Security. But Trump has warned that the administration could focus on programs that are important to Democrats, quote, "cutting vast numbers of people out, cutting things that they like, cutting programs that they like," end quote. As agencies sort out which workers are essential or not, Smithsonian museums are expected to stay open at least until Monday. A group of former National Park superintendents urged the Trump administration to close the parks to visitors, arguing that poorly staffed parks in a shutdown are a danger to the public and put park resources at risk. Ahead of Wednesday's start of the fiscal year, House Republicans had approved a temporary funding bill over opposition from Democrats to keep government running into mid-November while broader negotiations continue. But that bill has failed repeatedly in the Senate, including late Tuesday. It takes a 60-vote threshold for approval, which requires cooperation between the two parties. A Democratic bill also failed with a 53-47 GOP majority. Democrats are leveraging their votes to demand negotiation. Senator Majority Leader John Thune has said Republicans are happy to discuss the health care issues with Democrats, but not as part of talks to keep the government open. More votes are expected Wednesday. The standoff is a political test for Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer, who has drawn scorn from a restive bank of left-flank voters pushing the party to hold firm in its demands for health care funding. Quote, "Americans are hurting with higher costs," end quote, Schumer said after the failed vote Tuesday. House Speaker Mike Johnson sent lawmakers home nearly 2 weeks ago after having passed the GOP bill, blaming Democrats for the shutdown. Quote, "they want to fight Trump," end quote, Johnson said Tuesday on CNBC. Quote, "a lot of good people are going to be hurt because of this," end quote. Trump, during his meeting with the congressional leaders, expressed surprise at the scope of the rising costs of health care, but Democrats left with no path toward talks. During Trump's first term, the nation endured its longest ever shutdown, 35 days, over his demands for funds Congress refused to provide to build his promised U.S.-Mexico border wall. In 2013, the government shut down for 16 days during the Obama presidency over GOP demands to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Other closures date back decades. Texas's redrawn U.S. House map that boosts GOP begins a key court test by John Hanna. A panel of federal judges will begin Wednesday to consider whether Texas can use a redrawn congressional map that boosts Republicans and has launched a widening redistricting battle ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. The case in an El Paso courtroom is the first test of Texas's new map, which was quickly redrawn this summer to give Republicans five more seats at the urging of President Donald Trump in an effort to preserve the slim Republican U.S. House majority. Civil rights groups and dozens of Black and Hispanic voters joined the lawsuit, saying the new map intentionally reduces minority voters' influence. Their lawsuit argues that the new district lines represent racial gerrymandering prohibited by the landmark 1965 Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Constitution. Texas Republican lawmakers and state leaders deny these claims, saying the map is a legal partisan gerrymander. The hearing is expected to last more than a week. It is unclear how quickly the judges will issue a ruling. The new map eliminated five of the state's nine, quote, coalition, end quote, districts, where no minority group has a majority, but together they outnumber non-Hispanic white voters. Quote, race and party have folded onto each other, end quote, said Keith Gaddy, a Texas Christian University political science professor who has testified as an expert witness in redistricting cases over the past 25 years. Quote, what could be seen as being racial gerrymandering could just be partisan gerrymandering, end quote. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2019 that the U.S. Constitution does not prohibit partisan gerrymandering. Texas says critics cloak partisan fears in rhetoric about race. The new Texas map is designed to give Republicans 30 of the state's 38 House seats, up from 25 now. The state's attorneys argue that that Texas officials' persistent statements about their partisan motives show they weren't engaged in illegal racial gerrymandering, but were in a, quote, political arms race, end quote, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton's office said in a recent court filing. The move in Texas has subsequently led some other states, Republican-led as well as those led by Democrats, to respond with some redistricting plans of their own in a scramble to try to dominate the midterm elections. California countered by putting a proposed map on the ballot in November to pick up five Democratic seats. Missouri redrew its lines last month to give the GOP an extra seat. In court filings, Paxton's office argued that Republicans are offsetting past Democratic gerrymanders, and the Texas map's critics, quote, seek to use race as a foil to kneecap Texas's efforts to even the playing field, end quote. Quote, whenever they do not get what they want, they cry racism, end quote, its filing said. The case will be heard by a panel of three judges, one each appointed by Trump and Presidents Barack Obama and Ronald Reagan. Attorneys for groups and voters challenging the map aim to show that a trial is likely to prove the new lines deny minority voters opportunities to elect candidates of their choosing. Quote, states have to follow rules when they redistrict, end quote, said Nina Perales, an attorney representing some of the voters and groups, including the League of United Latin American Citizens. Quote, they provide essentially the buffer guards to protect the democratic process, end quote. The judges are likely to hear a detailed analysis of voting patterns. Quote, the minority community has to be what's called politically cohesive, which tends to mean that members of that community overwhelmingly tend to prefer the same candidates in elections, end quote, said Richard Pildes, a constitutional law professor at New York University. The new map decreased the total number of congressional districts in which minorities comprise a majority of voting-age citizens from 16 to 14. Republicans argue the map is better for minority voters. While five, quote, coalition, end quote, districts are eliminated, there's a new 8th Hispanic majority district and two new black majority districts. Critics consider each of those new districts, quote, a sham, end quote, arguing that the majority is so slim that white voters, who tend to turn out in larger percentages, will control election results. Quote, there is a growing animus against African American and other communities who have historically been disenfranchised, end quote, said Derek Johnson, the NAACP's national president. Quote, this is consistent with the current climate and culture germinating from the White House, end quote. Critics also argued that the 2021 map itself didn't have enough minority districts. For example, Perales said, Houston has enough Hispanic voters for two such districts, and the new map has one. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Israel orders Palestinians to leave Gaza City, saying those who stay will be considered militants, by Wafa Sharafa and Sami Magdi. Israel's defense minister on Wednesday ordered all remaining Palestinians to leave Gaza City, saying it was their, quote, last opportunity, end quote, and that anyone who stayed would be considered a militant supporter and face the, quote, full force, end quote, of Israel's latest offensive. At least 16 Palestinians were killed across the territory, according to local hospitals, as Hamas weighed a new proposal from U.S. President Donald Trump aimed at ending the war and returning the remaining captives taken in Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack that triggered it. Around 400,000 Palestinians have fled famine-stricken Gaza City since Israel launched a major offensive last month aimed at occupying it, but hundreds of thousands remain, many because they cannot afford to leave or are too weak to make the journey to tent camps in the south. Quote, this is the last opportunity for Gaza residents who wish to do so to move south and leave Hamas terrorists isolated in Gaza City, end quote, Defense Minister Israel Katz wrote on X. Quote, those who remain in Gaza will be considered terrorists and terror supporters. At least seven people, including first responders, were killed when two Israeli strikes, minutes apart, hit a school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City, according to Al-Ahli Hospital, while the casualties were taken. Officials there said more than three dozen people were wounded. Five Palestinians were killed later in a strike on people gathered around a drinking water tank elsewhere in Gaza City, the hospital said. Shifa Hospital said a man was killed in a strike on his apartment. Strikes in central Gaza killed another three people, according to Al-Auda Hospital. Another strike hit a tent in the courtyard of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in the central town of Deir al-Balah, seriously wounding two people, according to hospital officials. Earlier on Wednesday, at the same hospital, dozens of people attended a funeral service for a Palestinian freelance journalist, Yahya Barzak. He was killed Tuesday, along with five other people, in an airstrike while working for Turkish broadcast outlet TRT. More than 189 Palestinian journalists and media workers have been killed by Israeli fire in Gaza since the outbreak of the war, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. There was no immediate comment from the Israeli military on Wednesday's strikes or the strike that killed Barzak. Israel states it tries to avoid harming civilians and blames Hamas for their deaths, saying its militants are embedded in populated areas. The military said sirens sounded in communities near Gaza on Wednesday afternoon after, quote, two projectiles, end quote, crossed into Israel. No injuries were reported. Israel's campaign in Gaza has killed more than 66,000 Palestinians and wounded nearly 170,000 others, according to Gaza's health ministry. The ministry does not differentiate between civilians and militants in its toll, but has said women and children make up around half of the dead. The ministry is part of the Hamas-run government. UN agencies and many independent experts view its figures as the most reliable estimate of wartime casualties. The Hamas-led attack on southern Israel nearly 2 years ago killed some 1,200 people, and 251 others were abducted. Most of the hostages have been freed under previous ceasefire deals, but 48 are still held in Gaza, around 20 believed by Israel to be alive. On Wednesday, Egypt's Foreign Minister Bader Abdelhadi said Trump's proposal requires more negotiations on certain elements, echoing remarks made by Qatar a day earlier. Hamas said it would study the plan, and it was not clear when it would respond. The comments by Qatar and Egypt, two key mediators, appeared to reflect Arab countries' discontent over the text of the 20-point plan that the White House put out after Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced they had agreed on it Monday. The plan, which has received wide international support, requires Hamas to release hostages, leave power in Gaza, and disarm in return for the release of Palestinian prisoners and an end to fighting. The plan guarantees the flow of humanitarian aid and promises reconstruction in Gaza, placing it and its more than 2 million Palestinians under international governance. However, it sets no path to Palestinian statehood. The Palestinian Authority and the occupied West Bank, led by rivals of Hamas, has welcomed the plan, as have Egypt, Jordan, Indonesia, Pakistan, Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. The Israeli military said that starting at midday Wednesday, it would only allow Palestinians to flee south from Gaza City and not to head north on the only north-south route still opened. Around 90% of Gaza's population has been displaced in the war, often multiple times, and finding food is a daily struggle for many. On Wednesday, the International Committee of the Red Cross said intensifying warfare in Gaza City forced it to suspend its operations there and relocate staff to southern Gaza. Meanwhile, a widely watched flotilla of activists carrying a symbolic amount of humanitarian aid is sailing toward Gaza in what organizers have described as the largest attempt to date to break Israel's maritime blockade of the Strip. The activists aboard the global Sumud flotilla of about 50 vessels say they expect Israeli authorities to intercept them, as has happened in past flotilla attempts to reach Gaza. On Wednesday, they said two of the vessels were harassed by Israeli warships overnight. The core vessels set sail from Barcelona, Spain on September 1st, and the flotilla could reach Gaza shores by Thursday, organizers said. Israeli authorities warned the boats would not be allowed to reach Gaza. Thursday is Yom Kippur, the high Jewish holiday of the Day of Atonement, when stores, businesses, public transportation, and broadcasting shut down in Israel, beginning around sundown on Wednesday. Hurricane Imelda rumbles toward Bermuda as airports, schools, and government offices close, by Danica Cotto. Hurricane Imelda barreled toward Bermuda on Wednesday as forecasters warned that it would swipe past the tiny British territory as a Category 2 storm. Heavy winds and rain were expected to start hitting the island and continue through Thursday, with Imelda forecast to pass near or over Bermuda on Wednesday night. A hurricane warning was in effect for Bermuda, a wealthy overseas territory with strong structures that have withstood powerful storms in previous years. Imelda was located about 340 miles, or 550 kilometers, west-southwest of Bermuda. It had maximum sustained winds of 100 miles per hour, or 155 kph, and was moving east-northeast at 20 miles per hour, or 31 kph, according to the U.S. National Hurricane Center in Miami. Quote, "This is a dangerous storm system that could bring destructive winds, heavy rainfall, and significant coastal impacts," end quote, said Michael Weeks, Bermuda's national security minister. Bermuda closed its public schools and international airport on Wednesday, with government offices and businesses expected to do the same by the afternoon. More than 900 customers were already without power by Wednesday morning, officials said. Imelda is expected to drop up to 4 inches or 10 centimeters of rain across Bermuda and produce a dangerous storm surge that forecasters say could unleash flooding. Earlier in the week, Imelda pummeled the Northern Caribbean, unleashing widespread flooding in eastern Cuba, where 2 people died. In the province of Guantanamo, more than 18,000 people were evacuated, while in Santiago de Cuba, flooding and landslides cut off access to 17 communities where more than 24,000 people live, according to state reports. On Wednesday, more than 3,500 people remained evacuated in Guantanamo while crews began to repair damaged roads and bridges in the area. Meanwhile, authorities in Haiti said that 1 person is missing and 2 were injured following heavy flooding in the country's southwest and northwest regions. Hurricane Humberto dissipated on Wednesday after passing west of Bermuda on Tuesday. Imelda and Humberto's remnants were generating dangerous surf and deadly rip currents, affecting beaches along the North Caribbean, Bahamas, Bermuda, and much of the U.S. East Coast. At least 5 unoccupied houses along North Carolina's Outer Banks collapsed into the ocean on Tuesday, according to the U.S. National Park Service, marking the latest private beachfront structures to fall into the surf there in recent years. This Atlantic hurricane season marks the first time in 10 years that a hurricane hasn't made landfall in the U.S. through the end of September, according to AccuWeather, a private U.S. weather forecasting company. Quote, "This hurricane season so far is quite unique, with several close calls for the United States," end quote, said Alex Da Silva, AccuWeather's lead hurricane expert. Only Tropical Storm Chantal made landfall in the U.S. earlier this year. He noted that Humberto pulled Imelda away from the U.S. East Coast in what's known as the Fujiwara effect, a rare phenomenon in the Atlantic in which 2 storms are so close together that they start rotating counterclockwise around each other. Humberto and Imelda were a mere 467 miles or 751 kilometers apart earlier this week, the closest distance recorded between 2 Atlantic hurricanes since 1853, according to Michael Lowry, a hurricane specialist and storm surge expert. While the Atlantic hurricane season is winding down, Da Silva urged people to remain alert. Quote, "We expect atmospheric conditions that could support tropical storms and hurricanes well into late October and November this year," end quote, he said. Imelda, which reached hurricane strength on Tuesday, is the Atlantic season's 4th hurricane this year. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration had predicted an above-normal season with 13 to 18 named storms. Of those, 5 to 9 were forecast to become hurricanes, including 2 to 5 major hurricanes, which packed winds of 111 miles per hour or 178 kph or greater. The Atlantic hurricane season runs from June 1 to November 30. Swiss glaciers shrank 3% this year, the 4th biggest retreat on record, experts say, by Jamie Keaton. Switzerland's glaciers have faced, quote, enormous, end quote, melting this year with a 3% drop in total volume, the 4th largest annual drop on record, due to the effects of global warming, top Swiss glaciologists reported on Wednesday. The shrinkage this year means that ice mass in Switzerland, home to the most glaciers in Europe, has declined by 1/4 over the last decade, the Swiss Glacier Monitoring Group, GLAMOS, G-L-A-M-O-S, and the Swiss Academy of Sciences said in their new report. Quote, "Glacial melting in Switzerland was once again enormous in 2025, the scientists said. A winter with low snow depth combined with heat waves in June and August led to a loss of 3% of the glacier volume. Switzerland is home to nearly 1,400 glaciers, the most of any country in Europe, and the ice mass and its gradual melting have implications for hydropower, tourism, farming, and water resources in many European countries. More than 1,000 small glaciers in Switzerland have already disappeared, the experts said. The teams reported that a winter with little snow was followed by heat waves in June, the second warmest June on record, which left the snow reserves depleted by early July. Ice masses began to melt earlier than ever, they said. Quote, glaciers are clearly retreating because of anthropogenic global warming, end quote, said Matthias Huss, the head of GLAMOS, referring to climate change caused by human activity. Quote, this is the main cause for the acceleration we are seeing in the last 2 years, end quote, added Huss, who is also a glaciologist at Zurich's ETHZ University. The shrinkage is the fourth largest after those in 2022, 2023, and back in 2003. The retreat and loss of glaciers is also having an impact on Switzerland's landscape, causing mountains to shift and ground to become unstable. Swiss authorities have been on heightened alert for such changes after a huge mass of rock and ice from a glacier thundered down a mountainside that covered nearly all of the southern village of Blatten in May. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Walmart plans to remove artificial colors and other food additives from store brands by 2027. By Anne D'Innocencio and Jonelle Alessia. Walmart said Wednesday that it plans to remove synthetic food dyes and 30 other ingredients, including some preservatives, artificial sweeteners, and fat substitutes, from its store brands sold in the United States by January 2027. The move, announced by the nation's largest retailer, amounts to an acknowledgement that American consumers and the U.S. government, under President Donald Trump, are paying attention to what goes into packaged foods. Walmart said its goals would affect about 1,000 products, including salty snacks, baked goods, power drinks, salad dressings, and frostings. Several of the ingredients on Walmart's removal list, however, already are banned, not widely used, or have not been used in the U.S. food supply for decades. Others were included despite no known problems or have been targeted by the Trump administration for review and possible elimination as an approved food additive, according to food safety experts. Still, the action represents a, quote, sweeping declaration and a considerable response to consumer demand and sentiment, end quote, for fewer additives in food, said Brian Ronholm, director of food policy for the advocacy arm of Consumer Reports. Quote, this is a good and well thought out list and represents a very positive step, especially considering the reach their private label brands have in U.S. households, end quote, Ronholm said in a statement. Walmart said the 14-month reformulation plan primarily would involve its largest private label food brand, Great Value. Customers also can expect changes in Walmart's market side and freshness guaranteed lines of prepared foods, and to some extent in its premium label Better Goods products, the company said. In recent months, major food companies such as Kraft Heinz, Nestle, and Conagra brands have pledged to eliminate petroleum-based synthetic dyes in coming years. Walmart took its news a step further by identifying other kinds of food additives in its phase-out timeline. The chemicals and compounds the discount retailer intends to eliminate encompasses the breadth of food manufacturing. For example, Walmart's list includes potassium nitrate, potassium nitrate, and potassium bisulfite, which are used as preservatives in processed meats, as well as the artificial sweeteners Advantame and Neotame. Many of the items on Walmart's list have raised concerns about potential health effects, quote, for a long time, end quote, said Thomas Galligan, a scientist who focuses on food additives for the Center for Science in the Public Interest, an advocacy group. Those include synthetic dyes, titanium dioxide, azodicarbonamide, propylparaben, potassium bromate, and phthalates, a chemical used to make plastic flexible. Health advocates have argued that phthalates in plastic wrap, plastic packaging, and plastic bottles can end up in food and beverages. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has limited but not ended their use in items that come into contact with food. But some of the 11 artificial food dyes detailed by Walmart were already banned, proposed to be banned, or haven't been used for years, including red number 4, red number 3, citrus red number 2, and orange B. The retailer also listed Simpless, a fat substitute that was phased out of the U.S. food market in 2023, and synthetic trans fatty acids, or trans fats, which the FDA effectively phased out the same year by determining that partially hydrogenated oils no longer were recognized as safe. Experts said some of Walmart's choices were surprising. Ronholm said he was not aware of problems related to toluene, anisole, or morpholine, three other additives Walmart plans to eliminate from its foods. Center for Science in the Public Interest President Peter Lurie questioned the inclusion of talc on the retailer's list. Galligan said his agency considers Advantame and Neotame, quote, to be safe, end quote. Overall, though, the initiative struck Galligan as a good commitment. Quote, however, as with any voluntary effort, it is very easy for Walmart to make bold promises, but it is a lot harder for them to follow through, end quote, he said. Quote, many companies, including Walmart, have previously made and then broke promises similar to this. So until we see reformulated products on store shelves, this is all just talk, end quote. Walmart said the additives selected for banishment reflected the availability of, quote, viable and scalable alternatives, end quote, for maintaining product quality, taste, and affordable pricing. In June, Walmart's wholesale club division, Sam's Club, said it would remove more than 40 ingredients, including artificial colors and the artificial sweetener aspartame, from its members' marked products by the end of the year. Walmart shoppers are also likely to see reformulated food items in the coming months, the company said. Among them, great value cheese dips made with paprika and annatto, a food coloring and spice that's derived from the seeds of the achiote tree, in place of yellow number 5 and yellow number 6, Walmart said. In the future, a new version of great value fruit spin cereal will not get its colors from red number 40, yellow number 6, and blue number 2, but from beta-carotene, annatto, blue-green spirulina, and juice concentrates, according to Walmart. Scott Morris, Walmart's Senior Vice President of Private Brands Food, Consumables, and Manufacturing, told the Associated Press that 90% of Walmart's private label foods don't contain synthetic dyes. He said Wednesday's new marks and acceleration of a process the company initiated in the last few years. Customers have been asking Walmart to get rid of certain ingredients, but replacing them with more natural alternatives is complicated, Morris said. The performance of the substitutes can vary significantly depending on whether a product is shelf-stable or needs to be refrigerated, he said. New versions need to be vigorously taste-tested with consumers, he said. Quote, every item's a snowflake, end quote, Morris said. The main factor that prevented Walmart from overhauling its food shelves sooner was a limited availability of approved alternatives, but the market for those is increasing, he said. Quote, now's the right time to make our declaration and be more broad with our application of the natural ingredients, end quote, Morris said. The federal government is also giving artificial food dyes increased scrutiny. Days before Trump returned to office, the FDA banned the dye called Red 3 from the nation's food supply, nearly 35 years after it was barred from cosmetics because of potential cancer risk. Livestock landscaping. Vermont ski areas employ goats and sheep to clear the slopes. By Amanda Swinhart and Holly Raymer. Months before the first snow beckons skiers, sheep and goats are hitting the slopes in Vermont. Dozens of animals have been mowing down overgrown vegetation at Jay Peak near the Canadian border. They are expected to clear 25 acres or 10 hectares over a 5-week stint, an experiment officials say is worth a try on part of the 300 acres or 120 hectares that need to be mowed. The goal is to gradually reduce the reliance on gas-powered mechanical mowers. Quote, "This year has proven that it can be done and be done successfully," end quote, said Andy Stanger, director of Mountain and Base Area Operations. Quote, "They're great employees. They take a lot of lunch breaks, but that's the kind of the idea," end quote. The animals wear special collars that emit a noise if they get too close to an invisible fence and deliver a mild shock if they cross the barrier. The collars also send data to the herd's owner, Adam Ricci, of Cloudbrook Grazing. Quote, "I can see where they're spending most of their time, and I also get a heads up if they're sick animals. I'll see a drop in activity, and then it'll give me a notification," end quote, he said. Using livestock for landscaping isn't new. More than 25 years ago, a New Hampshire electric company used 1,000 sheep to clear vegetation under power lines. In 2010, the University of Georgia brought in goats to control an invasive plant overtaking a section of campus. And the Nashville Chew Crew, a herd of sheep, has been working for the city's Parks Department since 2017. New York City has also used goats to clear parts of its parks. Ricci said his goats and sheep spent a busy summer cleaning up backyards, reclaiming abandoned farmland, gobbling up poison ivy, and removing invasive species from the grounds of a retirement community. Quote, "Ideally, we can scale this up to the point where it's working well, and then hopefully develop a model that can be used at other ski resorts as well," end quote, he said. Quote, "But there's still a lot to learn here," end quote. Further south, Magic Mountain Ski Area used a herd from Slippery Slope Goats last year to do its mowing. In both cases, the collaboration was facilitated by the Agritech Institute for Small Farms, an organization working to increase access to advanced technology that can help small farms stay in business while mitigating climate change. Goatscaping reduces the carbon footprint of vegetation control, reduces erosion, and increases a site's capacity to hold water, Ricci said. The cost per acre is similar to mechanical mowing, though he acknowledges the animals are slow. Quote, "Conventional methods, they're covering this whole entire site in about 10 days, end quote, he said. Quote, "So these guys work significantly slower than weed whackers do," end quote. But employees and visitors at Jay Peak have enjoyed the friendly herd, Stanger said. Quote, "It's a lot of fun to have them on the mountain," end quote, he said. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the 1st of October issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Rachel Durkin-Durga. Thank you for listening.